that's something which has been kind of missing in cognitive neuroscience, at least, because we have been doing a lot of studies which focus on one of the aspects of the human mind. But to have this integrative picture or understanding of how mind comes about, I think the only way you can start doing this is by building it. Is it the case that consciousness is like the most compact solution to the problem which organisms need to solve?
This is Brain Inspired.
Greetings, good people. This is Paul Middlebrooks. Hope you've enjoyed seeing your family and friends over these holidays. I apologize for the background noise that may be occurring during this little introduction. I'm at my brother-in-law's house with about 400 children, 300 dogs that you may hear. Somewhere around there, anyway. My microphone right now is sitting on one of the children's beds in their room. So, anyway, I hope it's not too bad and distracting. Today, I add to your holiday treats and bring you Marcel van Gerven, or as we say in America, Marcel van Gerven, I suppose we'd pronounce it. He is the head of the AI department at the Donders Institute for Brain, Cognition, and Behavior. That's at Radboud University in the Netherlands, where he runs his Artificial Cognitive Systems research group. So he's surrounded by folks interested in understanding the brain and using that understanding to build AI and vice versa. So the beautiful, productive cycle that we love here at Brain Inspired. Marcel and I talk about his life as head of the AI department at Donders and the challenge of keeping people in the research world instead of them going and taking high-paying jobs at companies that want in on the latest deep learning and data science boom, and the type of people that do stay in academia and forge ahead in the quest to understand things and solve problems. One of the things that Marcel's lab does is develop algorithms to reconstruct the images that someone viewed while in an fMRI scanner. There are various ways to accomplish this, but most recently, they've used a technique you've probably heard of called generative adversarial networks, or GANs. If you haven't heard of them, they were developed really recently in 2014 by Ian Goodfellow and Joshua Bengio and their colleagues. And GANs are a sexy topic in the news these days because they're being used to create realistic-looking pieces of art, including portraits and so on. Marcel describes how they work, and we discuss the recent paper from his lab reconstructing natural images that people were viewing while in the fMRI scanner. So they develop encoding models which predict fMRI responses in the people that are looking at the images, and decoding models which reconstruct those images from the fMRI activations. So we talk about why this is even a desirable thing to do, where it's headed from here, some of the shortcomings of GANs in general. And Marcel has his hands on a lot of projects, as you might guess. We also talk about his work to help restore vision to the blind by directly stimulating visual cortex. And of course, we talk about where AI and neuroscience are headed while they continue to hold hands. Marcel and I are Skyping from across the world. He's in the Netherlands. I'm in the United States. So there are a few instances where he cuts out just a bit, but I tried to patch them up as best I could. But I know you'll enjoy Marcel as much as I did. Special thanks to David and Farid this week for helping me make this podcast, by supporting it on Patreon. I make this thing all by my lonesome, so it takes a ton of time and effort, etc., etc. And you can support it by contributing just $2 per month. You can go to braininspired.co and click on the red Patreon button there, should you choose to do so. Show notes for this episode are at braininspired.co/podcast/23. Okay, here's Marcel. Marcel van Gerven, welcome, and thanks for sharing your time and knowledge with me here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So you're Dutch. Can we talk about the Netherlands just for a moment?
Sure, why not? What do you want to know?
It's not what I want to know. It's what I want to tell you. I'm Dutch as well. Somewhat.
No, you're kidding.
I have Dutch in my genes anyway, in my background. When I was in fourth grade, I actually had to give a presentation on, believe it or not, I was in a gifted program in elementary school when this was about 9 years old. I'm not sure if fourth grade means anything to you. The most popular girl in the school, and by my accounts, the prettiest also, she had a crush on me, and she even wrote me a note, and it had one of those, do you like me, circle yes or no? Is that a thing in the Netherlands?
Well, we do have multiple choice exams, so.
Anyway, I circled yes, and then I never gave it back to her because I was too nervous. But
wow.
But anyway, she ended up loaning me some wooden clogs for my presentation in my little course on the sort of my family background. So there's a little bit of Dutch in me. So this should be a great conversation, I would imagine.
Oh, okay, yeah. So I guess we Dutch people, we don't all work on wooden clogs anymore, but I have seen them in the past, yes.
Do you ever see any these days? You don't, do you?
In the tourist shops.
Oh, sure. But not in the fields, not people.
No. Well, probably if you go to some very remote areas of the Netherlands, then maybe, but it's not very conventional.
But see, my Dutch friends tell me there aren't remote regions. There aren't forests and natural areas in the Netherlands anymore.
Well, so I remember this one quote where there was like this foreign visitor, and he landed in Schiphol in Amsterdam, and he basically drove all the way through the country. And at some point at the other side of the country, he mentioned, well, when are we going to leave Amsterdam?
So, oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a densely populated area, but there's still some nature reserves and forests.
I see. Well, my friends, a gentleman I worked with, who's now back in the Netherlands, we went camping together, and he marveled at all the natural space in the United States still. So when you're here, when you're in the States, you think, oh no, it's all becoming urban. And then I guess if I visited the Netherlands, I'd feel better about it.
I guess so. It's one of the most densely populated areas, I think, in the world.
Is that right? Yeah. I didn't know. Okay. Well, thank you for that. So Marcel, you are head of the AI department at the Donders Institute for Brain, Cognition, and Behavior. And this is at Radboud University. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly.
Perfect.
Oh, great. So congratulations, I think.
Yeah. It's an exciting time to be here and to help develop the field of AI at our university. I think it's also quite exciting that we are based in an institute for neuroscience, and I think that creates a very interesting and vibrant atmosphere at the interface between both AI and neuroscience.
Well, I want to talk more about the AI department there, but just, you know, to sort of introduce you a little bit more, you actually got your undergraduate degree at Radboud, and you've worked at the Max Planck Institute, and you also got your PhD at Radboud University. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I studied here, then I've been here and there at the Max Planck Institute. I've been at UCL for a bit of time. And then I went back, did my PhD here and in Amsterdam at the Dutch Cancer Institute. And basically, I was developing machine learning techniques to predict treatment outcome in cancer patients.
I see.
And then I actually got a postdoc at the Donders Institute, focusing on brain-computer interfacing, and from there on I became staff. And at this point, I'm basically head of the department where I once started to study myself. That's an interesting journey.
It really is interesting. But you also, you went to industry at some point and worked on some educational games using, and worked on like AI software, right?
Yeah, true. So I've been in industry for like 1.5 years, and then I realized, well, the academia is basically my place. So yeah, I spent some time there and then went back into academia.
I see. Okay. So you also run the Artificial Cognitive Systems Research Group there. And sort of the goal is to use what we know about human intelligence in our brains and cognition to develop AI. So you guys study human cognition and artificial intelligence and the human-machine interaction and interface, like you were just mentioning. And there's even keep a blog. I guess there's a variety of writers in the blog, but it's mindcodeec.ai.
we call it Mind Codec. Mind Codec.ai.
Yep.
And it's basically members of my research group who are writing on bits and pieces on things related to either neuroscience or AI, and preferably both.
Preferably both. So you're a perfect fit for this show. So it's perfect. So let's talk a few minutes more about just the AI department and sort of your role in it. So is the department itself a year old, or have you just been appointed as the head for a year?
I've been appointed as the head for a year, but the department has been around, I think, for, well, maybe even 20 years.
Is that right?
So it has been there for a long time, and it basically grew out of cognitive science. So our AI department is based in the Faculty of Social Sciences, and this is because it has its roots in cognitive psychology and cognitive science.
Right. Okay. So what is the intention of, and the current overall picture of the AI department there?
Yeah, so AI is, of course, a hugely broad field. And given our cognitive roots, we are really focusing on cognitive AI. So really thinking about ways in which psychology or neuroscience can inform AI, or thinking about ways in which AI can help neuroscientists and psychologists understand the human mind better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the main focus of the department. Some people in the department are also focusing more on the societal impact and the ethical implications of developing AI techniques, and our focus is mainly human-centered. So we place the human central, and we focus on different aspects.
And the field, it seems like, I guess this is my little bubble because I do this little podcast, but it seems like this field in academia, in universities, is really exploding, the interface between AI and neuroscience, and neuroscientists working with AI researchers and vice versa. Is that a false impression that I have? Are you guys growing? Do you see the field growing in the world, et cetera?
Yeah, so it depends a bit on where you come from. So if you look at the field of AI, of course, it can also be rooted completely in engineering. And one argument there could be, well, we completely don't care about the brain. We just want to build artificial systems, and who cares that it's either that it's mimicking the brain or not. So in a way, that's true. If you want to build these artificial systems, yes, then why care? But I still think, on the one hand, I think that we can take a lot of inspiration from human brain function. And of course, historically speaking, AI has its roots there.
You mean on the neurotechnology side, we could still take inspiration from brains?
Well, I would say on the algorithmic or functional side of things. So yes, we can build very advanced AI systems, but they are nowhere near the flexibility or the adaptive nature of our own brains. So I do think that by investigating the human brain, we can also start building more advanced artificial systems. At the same time, my interest is also fundamentally in understanding the human mind, and I think AI is one of the ways to get there, to at least mimic the human mind or the human brain in artificial systems, and trying to gain some knowledge from this.
I wonder if the AI approach it's exciting, but I wonder if one of the reasons why it's exciting is because people like me, even in my postdoctoral research, kind of ran up against this, not wall, but where things were kind of slowing down and think, okay, now where can I go from here? Not that there weren't plenty of projects to do, but to understand the mind, right? Because I'm doing electrophysiology, and along comes AI, and it's sort of this new, unknown, potentially limitless type of thing. So I wonder if we're all fooling ourselves, and it's just super hyped up right now, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. So I don't think we are fooling ourselves. I also think it's quite hyped up at the moment. So I think there are large promises in media, etc. But I'm quite convinced, actually, that AI and definitely the reappearance of neural networks are really going to offer us new insights into human brain function. And I think, in a way, that's also, well, as also working in cognitive neuroscience, I think this is one of the ways we want to start doing things. So I think we have been collecting a large mass of knowledge and data about the human brain, but there are no well, no ways to get a complete understanding of how to build a mind, right? And I think AI is giving us this model-based approach of building a model, training it on certain tasks, letting it loose in the environment, and actually starting to test how this corresponds to our own ideas about how the human brain fulfills certain tasks. So I think that's something which has been kind of missing in cognitive neuroscience, at least, because we have been doing a lot of studies which focus on one of the aspects of the human mind. But to have this integrative picture or understanding of how mind comes about, I think the only way you can start doing this is by building it.
Okay, well, so logistically, let's say for a second, not just logistically, but so you've been the head of the department for a year now, of the AI department. Have you, I mean, what kind of challenges have you faced? Has it been all super easy?
So that's a good question. So I think one of the challenges, and it's kind of a luxurious position to be in, but we had a very rapid increase of students, and I think all AI departments are facing the same challenge.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's nice. We are growing. There's a lot of interest. At the same time, how do you manage these large numbers of students? And what we decided to do is to put a cap on the number of students, because I think it's also important to be able to offer good student support and supervision, which means that you need enough staff members to manage those students. Luckily, our university, the faculty, the department, they are all realizing that we need to invest a lot in AI. And so we now have the means to attract many additional staff members. So we basically are aiming for controlled growth. I think things are looking very nice. We are offering new positions, and I think it's a really exciting time to actually be head of an AI department, at least definitely more exciting than 20 years ago.
Oh, so your challenge is that you're growing. That's a good problem to have. That's good. Was that a job offer to me, Marcel? Was that your, okay.
Well, we still have some vacancies left.
Okay. Well, so you're having this influx of students, right? So then they go through the program, and you yourself, you went to industry for a year and a half, and then you came back into academia. What I imagine is people are getting these skills and then moving into industry and making hundreds of thousands of dollars per year in American, U.S. currency anyway. So is that an issue of just... So the students are going to come in, are they then just going to disperse and leave, leaving a hole behind them?
Yeah, that's an issue we see across the board. So not only for students, but also staff members. There are so many opportunities now. And well, from a financial point of view, being a full professor in AI is not the best career move, I would say, because there are so many other opportunities.
Oh, yeah. You've got to really want it. Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think the students we do attract and the staff we do keep, at least in my department, are also people who are fundamentally interested in understanding this utmost complex object, namely the brain, and how does it fulfill these tasks. This inherent motivation is really what's driving us, and I think that makes it a very exciting place to be in. And I, yes, I see this outflux of people, but I also see that there's still enough people who really, well, are not aiming for the more applied side of AI, but are aiming for more theoretical fundamental understanding. And you can do this in companies as well, but you can definitely also do this in academia.
I think that game is changing too, that a lot of companies are hiring university departments or working with university departments. And vice versa. So that might be opening up a little bit. I'm not sure, really.
Yeah, I think so. And also what I see at our institute is we have also surrounding us many great cognitive scientists, cognitive neuroscientists, systems neuroscientists, lots of facilities to do brain imaging, either invasively or non-invasively. Mm-hmm. And I think having those resources, that's quite a unique position to be in from an AI department point of view.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to transition here in just a minute and talk about some of the work that you've done recently. But before we do that, I have a question. Just for people listening out there, to get a head start for them, what's an area or like a focus of research that you don't have time for, or maybe don't have resources for in your own lab, that you hope someone else will work on?
Well, I can give two answers to this, so I can stay bit close to my own research. And well, what I'm noticing in my own lab is that we are focusing more and more on the more theoretical side of things. Yeah? So really new algorithm development, theoretical understanding of natural intelligence, which means that there's less time for the applied side of things. And I think there are so many exciting applications nowadays, either in healthcare or in neurotechnology, neuroprosthetics, brain-machine interfacing. We are definitely doing research there, but I think we need to connect there to the more clinically oriented people in order to really make a difference. I would definitely hope to be able to hook up to those people. More broadly, we are focusing on human-centered intelligence. I also think we have to focus on something like, AI for the environment or AI for sustainability. I think there's a big challenge there. Mm-hmm. And, well, I don't have the time to focus on these questions, but I think they are very, very important. And I sincerely hope that other people are picking this up.
Ah, good. Okay, so finally, before we move on here, what is it like describing what you do when you're talking to family and friends who aren't familiar, you know, who aren't experts on this topic? Because I find it's never a great experience in my in my experience. How do you do it, and is it pleasant?
I recently gave my inaugural speech. And there, well, this speech is, of course, geared towards a more layman audience. And, well, that's maybe an interesting quote. So I wrote the speech because you basically write a small booklet accompanying the speech.
Oh, I didn't know.
And, well, at least in the Netherlands. And the first time I gave the speech to my girlfriend and just to have a chat. And at the end of reading the speech, she was like, I have no clue what you're talking about.
It's awful, right? It's so awful.
That was quite a terrible experience. But at the same time, the second time around, I think this speech came out really nicely. And, well, everything was quite understandable. Also, in the inaugural speech, people picked up on the ideas, which was really nice. At the same time, you can never really talk about what you're working on. So, yes, I can talk about trying to understand how the brain works, trying to build truly intelligent machines. But at the same time, concretely, we are working on things like Wasserstein variational gradient descent.
Gaussian
kernels. Exactly. Well, so you never can really talk about the stuff you're working on.
Yeah.
But that's fine.
Okay, well, it's hard to know, even doing the podcast, the balance, you know, between how to technically how much to dive in and how much to keep it on the surface. But let's dive in a little bit to some of your recent work. And one of the things I want to focus on, so I haven't had anyone on the podcast with whom we've spoken about using functional MRI-based neuroscience research. And so I wanted to talk about this. You've done this recent work with fMRI and artificial intelligence, such that you're able to read people's deepest dark secrets and thoughts and desires. That's what you do with fMRI and AI, right, Marcel?
Well, I know you know that that's not exactly what we are doing. So yes, we are we're developing new decoding algorithms or reconstruction algorithms, and we're basically applying this now to read out visual perception. So that's something we have been focusing on quite a bit.
Yeah, so you've been doing this for a little while now, and this technique's not new, but the idea is to put someone in a scanner and then use some equations to reconstruct what they might have been seeing in the scanner, be that handwritten digits or, you know, in your case, you've done studies with reconstructing faces. And this most recent one, I'll just read the title now, it's Generative Adversarial Networks for Reconstructing Natural Images from Brain Activity. And in this one, you're getting more and more complicated, these images that you're reading out from brains and then using some algorithms to reconstruct the image. And even that's not new. So I guess fMRI to reconstruct images started around 2011. Does that sound right?
Using fMRI, yes, I think a little bit earlier, but around that time.
But using deep learning techniques is pretty new, and you have been doing that, incorporating it with other techniques for a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
So, just on a really high general level, why do we even want to reconstruct the images that people are seeing?
Yeah, that's a good question, because of course you could say, well, why should I use the brain to reconstruct this? I can just look at the original images which has been, right. been shown to the subject. So this might seem like a futile exercise. So I think there are two reasons. So these reconstruction approaches are basically decoding techniques on steroids. And if you look at decoding, that's basically an established approach in computational neuroscience, also trying to figure out what certain neurons are responsive for. Right. And people have been developing techniques like reverse correlation in order to do so. Mm-hmm. This is in the same family of algorithms. However, we are trying to boost the sensitivity of these algorithms. So I think there are two reasons why we would want to do so. So if we can develop these reconstruction techniques well, then we will also be able to gain insights into what is encoded where in the brain. So we can start to probe different brain regions, different areas of the brain, maybe individual neurons or neuronal populations, and ask via reconstruction, basically visualize what are the properties those populations are sensitive to. So for visual perception, that's one thing. Of course, the holy grail is to take this one step further and to move towards more internal processes like imagery, working memory, internal speech decoding. So I think this will really offer a unique insight into these processes that are not otherwise, how do you say, we cannot access these otherwise.
Yeah.
So I think it will give us insights. At the same time, it also provides the basis for brain-machine interfaces that allow us to restore communication and control. So I think there's a scientific reason to want to develop and improve these techniques. And there's also an applied reason.
Okay, so do you want to just kind of take us through, we'll talk about what a generative adversarial network is in a few moments, but do you want to just walk us through like the setup and the way that the, you know, where the humans go and the computational flow, what goes in, what goes out, just to give the big picture and make sure everyone's up to speed?
Yeah, yes, I can do so. So the idea is that we start with a large set of stimuli, and in our case, naturalistic stimuli, let's say photographs of human faces, for instance. And basically what we do is we place people in the MRI scanner. We measure fMRI pulse responses while people are experiencing these stimuli. And then we are developing computational models that either tell us how a stimulus is encoded in the brain. So we go from the stimulus towards predicting the observed brain responses. So that's an encoding model. Mm-hmm. Or we are developing a decoding model, which takes the brain responses and basically reconstruct the original stimuli. And there's a nice correspondence between these encoding and decoding models, because you can basically show using Bayes rule that decoding models can actually be seen as an inversion of these encoding models, given a right image prior. So there's a nice correspondence between these, and building these models, that's kind of what we are up to. So the idea is we take a large stimulus set, a large set of observed associated brain responses. We estimate model parameters, let's say parameters of a decoding model, and later we apply to another set of observed brain responses where we don't know which stimulus has been shown. And then we see what the reconstruction is.
Okay, so I thought of this earlier. So an audio podcast is probably not the best way to talk about these things, because we can't show the images. But I'll link to the paper, and there's a preprint available that I'll link to in the show notes, of course. So how has image reconstruction sort of developed over time? Like I said, it's not completely new, but the deep learning addition is new. And you know, you've used other techniques in the past. So what has been your trajectory with what you've used in the past up to sort of what you're using these days?
Yeah, I already mentioned more basic reverse correlation techniques.
Yeah.
So there are simpler techniques we can use, and we also have been working on them ourselves. And these techniques have nice properties because they are analytically tractable. So for instance, in the past, we have been using models that assume linearity of responses, Gaussianity of the world around us, in order to basically obtain reconstructions in closed form. So if you have a certain encoding model, you can evoke Bayes rule, you can obtain these reconstructions in closed form. And that's really nice, and it works pretty well for basic images.
So the usage of Gaussian things to smooth out spike density functions, for instance, and for all sorts of processes, you know, Did you ever get flack for that? Even though it works really well, right? But the world's not Gaussian. A lot of the world's not Gaussian. I mean, did you ever get pushback on that?
Well, not completely. I mean, so I was really trained in machine learning. And of course, the simplest approach you could take is to just assume that everything is Gaussian and then everything becomes analytically tractable. And there the aim was to see, okay, if we make those assumptions, what do we get? And what we do see is that we can get very nice reconstructions of simple stimuli, like presented letters, which we have shown in the past.
Right.
But we also acknowledge ourselves that the world is not Gaussian, of course. And that's also why these models tend to fail if we move towards more complex stimulus settings like naturalistic images or photographs, etc. So we definitely need these more complicated nonlinear models in order to obtain better reconstructions. The downside is that we don't have analytical solutions anymore, so we need to come up with other strategies to achieve this these reconstructions.
I see. And so you did.
Yeah, well, at least we try. and we did. I mean, it's still hard to obtain crisp reconstructions for these more complicated stimuli. But I think definitely if you look at the face reconstruction work we have been doing in the past, we do see that those reconstructions start to look eerily similar to the presented stimuli.
So fast forward to today, and now you're using these generative adversarial networks. Reconstructing both faces, but this most recent paper that we're talking about, you're reconstructing these grayscaled natural images. Now, when I talked with Matt Botvinnik a couple weeks ago, he described GANs. I asked him what he thought of the recent artwork produced by GANs, because I found out he was an art history major, and I thought he might have a take on it, and his take was he doesn't like how realistic they're getting because it's less interesting, But let's dive a little bit deeper into how GANs actually work so that people just have that a broad understanding. So can you just describe that for me?
Yeah, so these generative adversarial networks consist of neural networks. So basically we have two neural networks that are in interaction with each other. So we have a generator network, and this generator network uses a deep neural network, starting with a random vector. So we just take a random sample, just some random vector. And the goal of this generated network is to transform this random vector into an image. And this image could, for example, be a human face. Then we take a discriminator network. This is also a deep neural network. And the goal of this discriminator network is to determine if a stimulus it sees is either a real stimulus or a stimulus generated by the generated network. So what happens is that these two networks are basically playing a zero-sum game against each other, where the generator tries to fool the discriminator, and the discriminator tries to identify which image was generated by the generator.
So the discriminator is also getting real images to vote on, right?
It either gets a real image or it gets a generated image. Mm-hmm. And if we then combine these two models, then we can actually define a loss function for both models, which allows us to train the models using standard gradient descent backpropagation techniques. Mm-hmm. And if we basically let those models compete against each other, what we see typically is that these generated images become closer and closer to the image statistics of the real images. So what we do in order to make these GANs suitable for reconstruction, for decoding, is we condition these random vectors on brain responses. So the goal of the model, which links the brain to these random vectors, is to predict the state of the random vector based on the observed brain response. So we predict the vector, we generate an image, and the goal is to make that image as close as possible to the image which has been shown to the subject in the MRI scanner.
Powerful.
Yes.
It's powerful stuff. So what happened? What were the results here?
If we look at the face decoding work, there we can really see that high level characteristics are reconstructed really well. So things like gender, ethnicity, age, whether somebody is smiling or not. So these things can be reconstructed. And then, of course, those reconstructions are still not perfect. But even within those subgroups, we can show that the reconstructions are better than what can be expected by chance. If we then look at the natural images, we can still show that these images are, the reconstructions are better than can be expected by chance. But I think the results are a bit less convincing in the sense that it's harder to identify the similarities between the reconstructions and the images which have been shown. And this also makes sense because we are basically assuming that these GANs should be able to capture anything, so anything in the environment. And these are this is really a hard problem, capturing the image statistics of arbitrary naturalistic images. So the nice thing of faces is that they are restricted in a way, but it also at the same time still variable enough to be interesting. And I think focusing on naturalistic images, that's the next step. We can do stuff there, but we still need to advance our algorithmic approaches. And we also need to, of course, advance our neurotechnological approaches. So we are still looking at regional blood flow and we're trying to reconstruct these really complicated images.
Yeah.
So there, yeah, we also need some improvements, I would say.
It's nice. In the paper, you provide a bunch of examples of images, the natural stimuli, which pass the human test, where the human recognizes that this image was the natural image presented before. And you also give examples of failures, right, where the decoded or the reconstructed image does not look very much like the natural image at all. So there's a lot of progress and, like you said, a lot more work to do, I suppose, which is good for you.
Yeah, it keeps us off the street.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Keeps you out of industry. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But so these GANs, you know, what you do is you use neuroscience to inform AI and vice versa. But are there anything like generative adversarial networks in the brain? Or should we look in the brain for something like this? You know,
I don't know. In a way, so something akin to GANs could underlie predictive processing in the brain. So I'm not saying that the brain consists of GANs. That's definitely not what I'm saying.
All the way down, yeah.
All the way down. But from a high level, in predictive processing, we are trying to predict our sensory inputs, which can then be compared with actual sensations, which can be used as a training signal. And this prediction can be seen as the generator part of a GAN, and the comparison with actual sensations can be seen as the discriminator part. So there's a nice analogy there, but I would see it as an analogy and nothing more than that.
I see. But so where do these GANs fall short? What's something that they're currently not doing very well?
So, of course, these GANs, they have been around only for a couple of years now. So it's still a relatively new area, but we know that they are suffering from certain problems. Things like convergence issues. So sometimes if we train those models, they tend not to converge.
Huh.
Or mode collapse. That's a very famous problem in GANs, where the generator basically collapses, which means that it only produces a low variety in the reconstructions.
Is that because it settles like in a local minimum, and so it can fool the discriminator really well, so there's a low error being given to it, and so it just keeps reproducing those types of images?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are multiple other problems. So yeah, we can suffer from diminished gradients, such that the discriminator can get really successful at predicting whether it's looking at the generated or the real images. Which means that the gradients start to vanish and nothing is learned. So there are various theoretical reasons why these GANs don't converge well or perform well. So there's a bit of black magic involved in getting them to work.
Right.
But at the same time, I think we are making great progress, better reconstructions, and we're also working on ways to fix things like mode collapse. So I think the field is just making rapid steps there, and we can piggyback on those.
There's really so much to do. So, I mean, on 60 Minutes, which is a popular sort of layman's news program here, they always show fMRI scans, you know, and they're always talking about the future of brain technology. And if they had you on, they would introduce you just like I did by saying, the man who's going to read our deepest and darkest secrets, you know, and read our brain activity and know exactly what we're thinking. So where are we with that grand, ridiculous vision? What you're doing right now, how far away is it? Where does it fit in that vision, you know, or relative to the unreality that is that vision right now?
So I think we can definitely do certain things, right? So we can read out those representations that are currently actively maintained in ongoing neuronal dynamics. Yeah, so we can observe brain activity using fMRI, for instance, and we can start to decode certain properties of things we perceive or either imagine, definitely for high level things. Yeah, so we can classify what somebody is thinking of or looking at.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also kind of obvious in a way. I mean, we know that if we're looking at faces, that FFA starts to respond. And well, if we can read out FFA activity, well, then we can decode something like that. So
yeah.
I think there we can take many, many steps. And I think we can reach the point that we could reconstruct the ongoing flow of thought, or at least our visualizations, maybe inner speech, things like that. But that doesn't say that we are able to read out things like beliefs, desires, and intentions, right? So these are basically encoded in whole brain synaptic traces that are not directly accessible by current techniques. So I definitely don't think we are touching upon those things. So I think in terms of privacy issues, we are still doing well.
You're safe, yeah. Well, my next question, I suppose, would be, do you think that the future of this technology resides in fMRI, using fMRI, or will we be using something like little nanoparticles to attach to all of our brain cells and read out the activity, et cetera? I mean, because it is, so fMRI has really great spatial resolution and really terrible temporal resolution, as people know. So is the future in fMRI here? Is it still going to be leading the way in 20 years, let's say, in this regard?
So we have not only been working on fMRIs, so we've also been using MEG, ECOG data, etc. And I definitely do think that we, in this area of research, we will move more towards invasive techniques. So think of high-density electrode grids, maybe calcium imaging, optogenetics type of work. So I do think that the future will be more in those domains, if we think about the applications of these techniques. And I think there also rapid progress is being made, and we can tap into that.
Great. So thanks for going over this recent work with me here. And now, I watched a talk you gave at VSS about 4 years ago. And your last slide, you had some future pointing questions, and your answers were on the slide. So can we just go through those, and I can get your take on how far we've come? And
I'm curious what my thoughts were at that time.
Okay, let me tell you what your thoughts were. I don't know what they are right now, because I'm not reconstructing anything. So the first, you had two big questions. One was, what's the most critical open question about visual representation? The most critical question that you offered was, what are the most important nonlinear transformations encoded by different neuronal populations up to the level of objects and categories? Looks like we've come a long way in that regard, or you have.
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, multiple groups have, and I think many many of the people you have already talked to in the podcast, mm-hmm. right? So I think we have come a long way. What I do see is that also the focus is shifting a little bit, especially for the people focusing more on the AI side of things. Yeah? So the question in the end is also, why do these object representations emerge? Yeah? So the brain is definitely not directly optimized to represent objects. It's optimized for something else. And of course, other people have also argued that the brain might be optimizing different kinds of cost functions. And we need to figure out how the brain, under certain evolutionary constraints, organizes itself. And I do think that if we apply the right constraints and we identify the right objective functions, many of the properties we see in our own brains also emerge in models, artificial models, that are subjected to the same kinds of tasks. So I do think that, well, the field is moving more in that area, right? So we're going beyond objects.
Yeah, it's crazy to think that we're talking about objective functions in the brain, but that's where we are, you know? So it's great from my background, from my limited scope.
Well, I mean, interestingly, of course, in the field of machine learning and AI, this has been something this is kind of the lingua franca we have had for decades, I guess. And what for me is really interesting to see is that the fields of neuroscience and AI who grew up together, drifted apart, but are now coming together again. And I think that's it's very exciting.
Yeah, it's exciting. That's why I'm doing the podcast. So it's exciting to me as well.
Yeah, and I must say it's a great podcast. We the whole department is listening to the podcast.
Oh, get out of town!
On a regular basis.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you very much. Thanks. I'm trying to make it better and better. You know, so I appreciate that. So your second main question on the slide was, what is the most important thing we need more of? And you listed three things. One was realistic encoding models whose feature spaces are obtained using unsupervised deep learning. I'll let you comment on that.
Okay. So I think what we what we definitely do need is this notion of synthetic brains, right? So trying to mimic in silico what the brain is doing. And I think there, yes, we can think about unsupervised techniques, but I think what we should start thinking about is how do we build these realistic models? Are neural networks good enough to do so? So on the one hand, we could say, well, all we need is a recurrent neural network because these are just ways to model any dynamical system. The brain is a dynamical system, so voila, we are done. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you could say, well, no, we need to start focusing on spiking models because the brain is basically communicating via spikes. Then people could respond, well, spikes are only relevant to facilitate long-range communication, and that's that. So I think addressing these questions is going to become really important. And in my group, we are focusing mainly on rate-based models, so standard recurrent neural networks. I mean, there are many functional properties of the human brain, which have been studied in various guises. And I think by building these in silico models, we can start to gain an understanding of why the brain functions the way it does.
Well, good. So the other two that things that we need more of on your slide were neural data recorded at the columnar level and sharing of models and data. And that last one I know you guys are really good at because you put all of your code is available and a bunch of data sets is available through the artcogsys .co website. So check off number three, I suppose, at least from your lab. But I was invited to give a talk. I recorded spiking neurons, right? And didn't model the data. And I was invited to give a talk, and it was a heavily modeling department centric group of people. And we were having lunch, and they said, why don't you guys like to give your data to modelers? And I felt kind of icky explaining it, but it's this data was really hard won, and I might model it one day. And of course, I never did. And I might still. I still have the data. But, you know, that wasn't a very good, satisfying explanation to them. So, but I think that the sharing of models and data is really coming along and becoming more and more the rule rather than the exception. I'm not sure what you think.
Yeah, I think so. And of course, I also hear you. I mean, we have recently collected quite a large data set. So we basically collected 40 hours of fMRI data in one of our master students. So he spent quite some time in the scanner.
Yeah.
Well, these data, they take some time to obtain. And of course, you also want to run your own analysis first. But I think, yeah, it's good practice to at some point make this available to the community. I also think it's important because I think it's important to be able to have people work on the stuff they do best. So yes, we collect our own data, but we're also developing algorithms and models. And I'd rather be focusing on the algorithmic part and collaborating with the people who really, really know how to collect at the highest quality possible data we can obtain, yeah, in order to get the best of both worlds.
But we have to learn cross-disciplinary skills these days too. So there's a balance in there somewhere, I suppose.
Yeah, somewhere. You definitely need to be able to talk to each other. That's definitely important. But I do think that the field is also becoming so specialized. So think about the more theoretical work. It's quite hard to be excellent both on the theoretical side and the algorithmic work and to be excellent on the data collection and neurophysiology side. So I think it's also important to form teams there and collaborate.
Well, Marcel, we were going to, I wanted to talk about some of your other recent work with recurrent neural networks that you've been doing and seeing the title of the paper is Emergent Mechanisms of Evidence Integration in Recurrent Neural Networks. And so this is where you guys model a decision-making task and use recurrent neural networks. So you're all over the place. You're doing lots of different kinds of work. So we're going to have to save that for next time when I demand, actually when I visit the Netherlands, my home country. And
yeah, if you're here, please drop by.
Oh, sure. I'll buy you a beer and we'll talk more.
That's great.
So another thing that you're working on is on the neurotechnology side, you have a project going on to restore vision to the blind. Now, there are multiple approaches historically and these days to restoring some sense of vision to people who suffer from various types of blindness. One of the earliest ones was a little tongue stimulator, right, where there was some sort of camera and it processed the visual stimuli, and then it would stimulate your tongue tactily And then people learned to use that tactile stimulation as a proxy for visual cognition. There are things like prosthetic retinas, replacing the eye lens with a tiny telescope. There's little microchips you can implant under your retina, and even gene therapies are coming along now. You guys are doing something different. Can you want to just give us an overview of the approach you're taking and the progress being made?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we are working together in a consortium of other mainly Dutch researchers. And the aim is to basically restore visual perception or visual sensation in the blind. And the way we approach this is basically using cortical implants. So the idea is that we directly stimulate early visual cortex, V1. And if you stimulate a certain location of visual cortex, we can basically generate a phosphene, so a light flash in your visual field. Mm-hmm. So the grids we are using at the moment, they are quite high density. So we have 1,000 contact points. And by stimulating each of these contacts individually, we can generate a phosphene. So if we can do this in a very targeted manner, we can start to generate patterns, which means particular visual sensations.
So the idea is not so much to restore the clarity of vision, but to present the subject with a pattern of phosphenes that they can then translate into knowing that there's a couch in front of them, for instance, or something like that?
Exactly. And I think the challenge is to optimize the phosphine patterns in such a way that the experience of a couch is basically instantiated.
Gosh, there's all sorts of plasticity issues here, too, that things are going to be dynamic and changing over time. So is it really early on in the work?
This is work together with my colleagues at the Netherlands Institute for Neuroscience. And there in primate work, we can definitely show that we can generate those phosphenes in a controlled manner. And this is still very early days, but I'm quite hopeful that in a couple of years we can establish some breakthroughs there. And I think it's one of the most exciting projects I at least ever worked on. So it's highly exciting from the neuroscience point of view, from the algorithmic point of view, and also from the societal impact point of view.
Yeah, my very first guess was Stephen Potter, and he said one of the reasons he loves what he does is because it's our job to solve problems. And I just felt guilty all of a sudden when he said that, because what I wanted to do was understand things, and what he wanted to do was help people. And I didn't care about helping people, you know? But I think anytime you can, and I think he's right, I think that should be the major reason why people work on these things. And so I'm learning to be a little bit less selfish as time goes on, hopefully, and because I think it's great.
Ideally, you get the best of both worlds, right? So I think it's highly satisfying to be able to work on such a project, but it's also extremely satisfying to, I don't know, write down a very elegant equation, or to figure out that your algorithm converges, or, right? There's also some theoretical satisfaction there. And I think, yeah, this balance is achieving this balance is nice.
I think I'm just on that. I'm kind of far on that side of the spectrum, unfortunately. But well, okay.
Also fine.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thanks. Thank you for that reassurance. Okay, Marcel, we've come to the time in the program where we both take shots of what are you drinking over there?
Well, at the moment?
Is vodka
or in
the
general?
Is the in general, let's say at the
no,
moment.
Vodka is more a Russian thing.
Well, here I know it's Russian, but What's the drink du jour in the Netherlands?
It's typically beer, and then typically Belgian beer, because they are better at making beers than the Dutch.
Okay, well, let's have some strong imported Belgian beer, or at least pretend to do so. And I have okay. some broader, more speculative questions, perhaps, for you. It seems like the more people I talk to, the general consensus is that we're really, really far from general AI, and that it's not time to be scared yet, that AI is going to take over the world and we're going to be its pets and things like that. But then there's a lot of people in industry, you know, and there's a lot of people in working on the ethics of the implications of all this progress that we're making. So I'm just curious what your outlook is regarding the time frame of achieving or not achieving general AI, general human level AI.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, I don't think we have to be that afraid of achieving AGI. I think we should be more afraid of the ways the non-AGI type of artificial intelligence is now ingrained within society and what are the implications of this. I think that's a more urgent problem at the moment. Of course, it's important to speculate about this and to think about the consequences of building machines that are able to surpass ourselves. But, well, maybe call me naive, but I think it's only very exciting. So I think it's very exciting that we're at least able to think about ways to build systems that might be able to mimic properties of the human mind. I think we're completely not there yet, and I think we still have a long way to go. But thinking about ways of building models that are forced to understand their environments by placing them in the right conditions and forced to build very expressive world models and forced to predict the consequences of their actions, I think that's really interesting. I think these are kind of the building blocks of building AGIs. And in the end, it will buy us intelligent algorithms that allow us to solve current societal problems in a more optimal manner. So I'm not that afraid of like these doom scenarios where Terminator type of robots will take over the world. But at the same time, I do think that currently AI is so ingrained in society that we should be scared about this because we didn't think hard enough about the potential consequences of using these systems. Okay, but how far are we from achieving this goal? I think still very, very far. And I think we are optimistic, but we also don't know if we're still missing ingredients, right? I mean, of course, you will at some point drop the magic word consciousness, and then I will start to shiver and scream. And
it's coming. Oh, it's coming.
It's coming. Okay, it's coming. Yeah.
Maybe if we have time.
Okay.
That's when everyone, anytime I ask like people, what do you want me to ask someone about? They're like, consciousness. Yeah. So, well, let me ask you this. So speaking of like the ethical implications of things, are you familiar with the trolley problem?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So let's say you're standing up on a hill and you're standing next to a neuroscientist and you see the train coming down below and you see an AI researcher down there. You can stop the train by throwing the neuroscience researcher in front of the AI researcher on the tracks. He or she is kind of a big, heavyset person, so it's going to take a little strength. So what do you throw the neuroscientist off and save the AI researcher, or do you let the AI researcher die?
It depends a bit on who the neuroscientist and the AI researchers are.
They're clones. They're clones. They're clones of each other.
They're complete clones, but they are neuroscientists or AI researchers. Can I spend like 10 seconds to think about this?
Well, in other words, I'll because 10 seconds would be not enough for me. So, here's an easier question: which do you think will have more influence on the other, AI on neuroscience or neuroscience on AI?
I think in the short run, AI will have a big influence on neuroscience. Maybe not only in terms of being able to model these generating these artificial cognitive systems that behave like brains, but also more in the context of developing new techniques to perform neural data science or to do neural data analysis, right? So I think coming from a machine learning point of view, if I look at the techniques that are currently used in neuroscience, I think there's still such a big gap between what we are able to do and what we are currently doing that I think that will make a big impact. And I think that's really important because what we see in neuroscience, of course, is that we are generating these larger and larger whole brain, single neuron, real-time data sets, and we know less and less well what to do with these data sets.
Right.
So I think their AI will play a very big role. And I think there are definitely people at the interface between neuroscience and AI who have a machine learning background who are really pushing the field forward. And I think that will be a major short-term impact. So in terms of neuroscience feeding into AI, people are also arguing, well, what did neuroscience really actually buy AI, right? So yes, some ideas or some concepts.
It gave birth to AI.
It gave birth to AI. But as an AI researcher, you could also say, okay, yes, it gave these nice ideas like convolutional deep neural networks, like the neocognitron, right, which comes from neuroscience, which gave birth to deep neural networks, which are now kind of all the craze in AI.
Right.
But in the end, AI is also applied mathematics. So when we truly understand what we are doing, we might not need neuroscience. I don't agree with this because I think there's so much knowledge in the field of cognitive psychology and neurophysiology which will be able to feed into AI, definitely at the functional level. So trying to understand how intelligent beings operate, because we are the existence proofs there. And hopefully, at some point, at the more algorithmic level, right? So maybe thinking about the ways backpropagation can be implemented in the brain, that's now a hot topic.
Yeah.
Neurophysiology might lead us into clues on how this could be achieved. And I think that will be a massive impact in AI. And that maybe takes a little bit more time.
Yeah, okay. I like that answer. What is something that you envision in the future that may seem a little bit out there to a layperson, or even to an educated person, maybe something that they might find hard to believe that you believe will occur?
I think we will be able to mimic the human brain to such an extent that we are able to build artificial systems that really behave very naturally in many, many ways. So I think we should be thinking much harder about, okay, what are the functional subsystems of which our brain is composed, and how can we build this into our artificial system? So I think this strong convergence between neuroscience, cognitive psychology, and AI will allow us to build systems that behave like biological organisms. The question is, what do we need in terms of ingredients? And I can imagine that we're currently modeling things a bit at the wrong level. So I think we are looking at it from a functional point of view, and I think we can get a long way there. We're also, of course, ignoring certain details which probably play a role, like dendritic computation and synaptic processes and maybe intracellular processes that are subserving cognition. So I think at some point we can mimic all of this in artificial systems and create very naturally behaving AI systems that look like they might be biological organisms.
That look like they might be.
Yeah, well.
That's the next question. You can begin to shiver now. So will those organisms, right, or those systems, will they be conscious? And or you could answer the alternative question. Do you think that work in AI and or neuroscience will help us understand consciousness, what it is, how to build it, and so on?
So it's kind of like a fingers crossed experiment, right? So if we build those systems and we subject them to the same constraints, is it the case that consciousness is like the most compact solution to the problem which organisms need to solve? If that's the case, then we can enforce it. However, it's really fingers crossed, right? Because we either build very smart zombies or we build conscious systems. And the question is whether consciousness naturally emerges. Yeah. Empirical question.
I like the way that you phrased that. Okay, so Marcel, thanks for your time. I have one last question for you here.
Sure.
So luck plays a role in everybody's lives and careers, and you've been very successful. Can you think back to a particular time that luck played a role, large or small, in some of the success that you've had?
So I think I can give like a social answer to this. So I think luck is also related to being surrounded by the right people at the right time. So I think much of the work I've been doing is done with a team of people. And I think if you resonate well with those people, you can really achieve really great things you cannot achieve on your own. And that's what I see in my department now, that it's like a vibrant community of people who all aim to understand natural intelligence. And I think I'm quite lucky to be able to have those people around me. So for me, that's the luck.
That's a great answer. I have been lucky to talk to you today, and the listeners have all been lucky that they've tuned in. Tell Katja I say hello and thank you.
I will do.
And I really appreciate the time, so thanks.
My pleasure.
Brain Inspired is a production of me. You can support the show through Patreon for a trifling $2 or $4 per month. Go to patreon.com/braininspired or go to the website braininspired.co and find the red Patreon button there. Your contribution will help keep this show going without any annoying advertisements like you hear on other shows. To get in touch with me, email paul@braininspired.co. The music you hear is by The New Year. Find them at thenewyear.net. Thank you for your support. See you next time. The stereo.